Welcome to the Curly W Live podcast. My name is Kyle Brostowitz and I am your host. First off, I would like to thank you for taking the time to check out our first podcast, wherever you may be listening from, whether it be home, school, work, car, the gym, anywhere you may be checking in. Thank you very much. So in addition to watching the games, as fans, you get your news and information and entertainment from places like nationals.com, MLB.com, our social media channels on Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, as well as the media outlets that cover the team, TV stations, radio, internet, newspapers. Fans over the years have also been able to read about the Nationals on Curly W Live, the official blog of the Nationals. On that site, you've read about our players, coaches, front office, community involvement through press releases, wrap-up posts, written interviews, video clips, etc. So in an effort to bring even more content to our fans via Curly W Live, we launched this podcast. We hope that we can bring you some stuff that you may find interesting and that you may not find anywhere else. So thank you again for checking in, and we really hope you enjoy what we put together. So as the spring training moves along and we head into the 2017 regular season, we are planning to record a podcast every few weeks. It will depend on the team schedule, other schedules, what's going on with the organization at the time, but we plan on doing this on a pretty consistent basis. Make sure you subscribe to the blog, Curly W Live, so you don't miss anything we put on there. The podcast will be available there, as well as nationals.com, and as we move forward, other places. We will be sure to keep you updated as those updates take place. So on this podcast, you'll find a discussion of the current team and minor league system. So every time we meet, we'll check in on where the club is, provide you some up-to-date information, game notes, highlights, things like that. But moreover, we will provide an inside look at Washington's front office through one-on-one interviews. And this is the part that I'm most excited about and what I think listeners will get the most out of. We aren't just going to stick to baseball on the field either. We hope to give you a bit of an inside look at the organization through interviews with people from various departments. We'll get into career paths, kind of a what do you do discussion, interesting stories from behind the scenes. You know, when you settle into Nationals Park at 7 p.m., for a game, a lot has gone on during the day to get to that point, so we hope to bring you some of that insight. We hope to have some player and coach interviews as well. We hope to do sit down with members of the baseball operations staff in addition to the business operations staff, and we will look to do some other special interviews as the opportunities present themselves. If there's special guests at Nationals Park, we hope to sit down and chat with them. Other chances to get connected with the Nationals family through whatever means possible, whether it's phone interviews or Skype interviews. So we're going to do our best to bring you, content such as that. So this week, our two guests are Mark Shalaba, the Director of Player Development for the Nationals, and Charlie Slows, who along with Dave Jagler serve as the radio voices of the Washington Nationals. In these interviews, both these guys brought some great insight into their careers, their preparation on a game day, their philosophies, as well as their thoughts on the current club. The first guest on this week's podcast is Mark Shalaba, the Director of Player Development for the Washington Nationals. Mark is entering his 12th season with the club and is a big part of the team that runs Washington's player development and minor league system. As baseball fans, you know that a club's farm system is integral to the success of the major league club. And Mark has been a part of the organization for so long, he has had a hand in development of just about every player that has come through the system. If you traveled to any one of Washington's affiliates, Syracuse, Harrisburg, Potomac, Hagerstown, Auburn, the GCL, the DSL, there's a good chance you'll see Mark behind home plate watching the game and probably on his phone checking the score of the Nationals game. So here's our interview with Mark. I hope you enjoy it. We are here in lovely West Palm Beach today, and with me is Mark Shalaba, the Director of Player Development for the Washington Nationals. Thank you, Mark, for joining us today. I know it's a very busy time, spring training, but first off, how does it feel to be the first guest in the history of the Curly W Live podcast?
No, it's quite the honor, Kyle. It's great. I'm excited to be here. This facility we just moved into is outstanding, so it's to be part of the first podcast is an honor.
All right. Well, Mark, for those who don't know, Mark's entering his 12th season with the Nationals, and in his current role, he works with Doug Harris on all aspects of the player development system, things like contracts, roster management, budgeting, the Dominican Academy operations, and player personnel decisions. He joined the Nationals in 2006 as the baseball operations assistant after working for the Brewster Whitecaps and receiving his degree from Williams College and his master's from UMass. So my first question, Mark, was a career in baseball always something you strived for and looked to do?
As a child, I was drawn to baseball, loved sports growing up, but really through college is when I started realizing that there was a chance that I would have an opportunity to pursue my interest in the game, but also kind of combine my business acumen, the economics degree, and some of the psychology courses I took. I really felt like I could combine that into something down the road and work in the game possibly. So that combined with some experiences along the way when I was at UMass Amherst for my sport management degree and my MBA, I worked with the Pirates, I worked in the Cape Cod League, and those opportunities provided me a chance to meet some people in the game, some tremendous mentors that helped propel my career into working for the Washington Nationals.
So right now we're on March 4th, we're recording this podcast. Early camp is in full swing, and I believe the rest of the minor league system are starting to report right about now. Is that right?
Yeah, we have our early camp has been going for about 10 days now. Our pitchers and catchers are here. Their first workout is this afternoon, and then we'll have our position players here on the 7th. So we stagger the groups, and it allows us to have a little more hands-on approach early on with a lot of our young prospects.
So what's the process like getting – I mean, we have 65 guys in big league camp, but in minor league camp, we have, 250 or so, 300 players? What's the process like to get all those guys housing, their physicals, all their equipment, food, things like that?
Yeah, we have a tremendous staff here. Ryan Thomas is our director of minor league operations, and he does an awesome job of basically taking the approach that we want to provide these players with the best environment to do their job, to learn, to grow. And J.J. Esteves, our manager of minor league operations, helps particularly with our Latin American players, but also all the players as a whole. And really, you're trying to provide them with an environment, the hotels, like you said, the food, the nutrition program that we've improved over the years. Really proud of where we are right now with that. We're taking it to the next level this year. But you're also dealing with travel and things like visas, and that process is, something that always is changing on the fly with different government laws, and there's always a challenge along the way with that. So your process really begins well early into the off season. You're starting to apply for visas and get everything set up in November, but you're always acquiring new players, and it's very challenging. So Ryan and JJ do a tremendous job along with our intern staff here, but we have everything down to clockwork at this point in time. We've been together for a long time. We have continuity, and they do a tremendous job.
So back to early camp specifically, how does it get decided who comes to early camp and kind of what goes on? Is it the same type of spring training practices and workouts just early on in camp? Is it accelerated in any way? Like, kind of give fans a rundown of what early camp's like.
Sure. The point of having an early camp for us is twofold. One, you obviously get the prospects in here earlier to give them a little bit closer, peer to student relationship. We're going to have about 20 staff members, around 45 players, and you're going to be able to work on some individual, defense, individual work on the cage, and really start setting the tone for pitchers, trying to make sure that they're in their throwing program the proper way. They're geared up to start throwing off the mound the proper way. And then secondly, you're also helping provide the Major League spring training camp with players to help supplement their game. So provide insurance, as we've seen the past few days. We had a couple games yesterday, and some of our young players on the road got in the games for the first time and had a few hits. So Calvin Gutierrez, Ian Sagdahl, a few of the names, but there's many more that participated in the games yesterday. So it's a great opportunity for them to get their feet wet, get some exposure to the Major League spring training, but also helps Dusty and his staff to bring over some players to provide some insurance and depth for them as well.
And then once all the players combine, once they all get here in the next week or so, do the early camp players kind of, I don't want to say regress, but move back and practice with the players that are getting here, or are they still somewhat ahead of everybody else?
Good question. Yeah, well, the way we structure it today is our first inter-squad game. We're going to play here in about a half an hour, actually, and we'll be out in the field playing a 7-inning inter-squad scrimmage, and we'll play those games. We'll schedule them out, make sure our pitchers start getting some innings on the mound. And, so it'll combine at some point closer to when our games start. Our official games start on the 16th. So we'll start putting players into groups based upon level probably 2 days before that. Mm-hmm. So they'll have work groups. We don't necessarily call it Syracuse, Harrisburg, but we'll call it work groups, AAA, AA, and we'll go from there because there's still players coming down from Major League camp. So it's constantly changing on a daily basis. You have movement and you're kind of shuffling players around from team to team, putting them in groups where we want to challenge them, but also give them a chance to compete for a position at that level.
So then once the season begins and you break camp down here, how often do you, in your role, do you get to go out and see each team, and do you kind of make it a thick goal to see each team once or twice, or how many times through the year?
Sure. You know, we're going to see as much as we can. We have a great staff in the minor leagues with our player development system. You know, obviously working for Doug Harris, I've learned a lot over the years, tremendous scout and evaluator, but tremendous leader as well. And working with Randy Nord, Spin Williams, Tommy Shields, and Jeff Garber at the top of our group. And then we have coordinators overseeing the programs. We really have a lot of eyes and ears throughout the organization, helping provide input with our managers and coaches. So for me and Doug, we're going to be out on the road a lot, and it's going to be broken down. Basically, for me, it's about half the time I'm in D.C., and then half the time I'm on the road, making sure I see each team a few times throughout the year. Because you see a player in April, it could be a lot different than hopefully July. You want to see progression. You want to monitor where they are, where they start, and where they end up. And you have to also provide at the upper levels evaluations for Mike and the staff in D.C. and the baseball operations department to make sure that we know what our depth looks like on a daily basis.
Okay, so a lot you mentioned before, you got either guys, non-roster invites that are, you know, prospects, or the minor league extra players come over. And when guys play well during the games, Dusty always makes it a point to mention that they do well at up in the big league games because they're being taught the right way in the minor league level. And he always, you know, gives you guys praise. If you guys had a general philosophy on the role of player development in our system, what do you think it would be?
I would say, I think we have a strong culture, and I don't want to give away too much of what that culture entails, but I think we have continuity has lent itself to having that culture. We play the game hard. We do everything, with an aggressive attitude, a strong work ethic. I think we don't let the little details slide. We empower our staff. We want to make sure we're teaching the game the way we want it to be played. But there's a lot of details that go into it that I really don't want to disclose that makes us unique. But, you know, it's, I think it's something that we're very proud of. And I think if you look at the way the players play when they go up to the big leagues and their intent, their aggressiveness, and then just continuing to learn the game and be a student of the game, and those are some of the things that I can, I guess, preach. But, I think it starts with, Mike at the top and having people like Bob Boone in this organization that has such a long history of not only just playing and at a very high level, but managing, coaching, and then, helping our coaches get better and our staff get better. He's been a tremendous asset to this organization for a long period of time. And, we've had some great baseball men in this organization that have experience, and just learning and listening to them and empowering our staff to teach our players and really strive to be the best they can be, and not just on the field, but off the field, and trying to make sure that they're at their peak levels at all times. So it's there's certainly different ways to skin a cat, but we're proud of what we have here at the Nationals, and just the tremendous people really make this organization unique, and I think that's a big part of our culture.
So to go along with that a little bit, and it's probably a lot of the same tenets and beliefs, but when after the draft in June and players start reporting the Gulf Coast League or Auburn, is there a message that you or Doug or the player development staff share with them about their first, foray into professional baseball?
Yeah, we just know it's a grind and it's a difficult process. I think that's one thing that people take for granted, is how difficult this game is to play on a daily basis, mm-hmm. and really go from a college or a high school environment. And for our Latin players, which we've done a tremendous job, I think, with Johnny DePuglia and Sandy Martinez running our academy down in the Dominican, just understanding that this game is difficult. You're going to have failure. Handling failure is an important part of it. But we have patience with our players as well, and understand that, might not have success early on, but doesn't mean that you can't have it down the road. And we're going to try to develop you as a major league player and into a major league player. We're not trying to get the best out of you in A ball. We're trying to make sure that we teach you and teach each player and provide them with opportunities that will help them be the best major league player down the road.
So how do you balance at each affiliate winning and preparing for the next level?
Yeah, I think that's always the big debate, but each individual is different. But we also want to make sure that our job is to maximize each player's potential ability. And we never will sacrifice a player's prospect's development for the chance to win a game. However, we also believe that a winning culture is the best environment for players to develop in. So we're gonna and you compete in all throughout, these athletes compete throughout their lives. I mean, if it's playing, backyard football or playing soccer or playing, ping pong or whatever they're doing, they're always going to be the best athletes are the ones that compete and compete at a high level and they want to win. I mean, you go out here and we're doing drills in the backfields, we're going to have competition back there. We want to see who's going to step up, who's going to compete and want to win. And then it transfers into the game later on. And we want winners. We want people to compete. But also the end goal is obviously to make sure that we maximize each player's ability so that, we either can provide that player for Mike and our staff in D.C. to be able to move that player or hopefully get him in a Nationals uniform in D.C.
Okay. So for a long time, or for the last couple, I shouldn't say a long time, for the last couple of years, the strength of the player development system and the minor league system, it seems like in the top 10, at least through various publications, has been pitching. That kind of transitioned a little bit this offseason, and now it seems that speed, athleticism, and up-the-middle players are kind of where the top 10 is right now. Do you feel the strength of the system, feel the strengths the same way that those publications do with, a lot of speed and athleticism up the middle?
Yeah, I think our depth right now and our prospects is more on the hitting side than the pitching side. But, I think our scouts have done a tremendous job over the years. And, we've moved a lot of talent out of the organization, mm-hmm. obviously. But we graduated some and made some trades. But I think right now we're very proud of the athletes we have in this field. And then you look at our outfield crop and you look at, obviously, Victor Robles. But you look at also Andrew Stevenson and Rafael Bautista at the top of the organization. And you go to a younger player like Blake Perkins and Daniel Johnson, who came out of the draft last year. Nick Banks is a bat that's coming. So, I mean, you look at some of these young men, and really it's an impressive tool set that each one has. And then you look at a player like Juan Soto, where his bat is, very advanced for his age. And, he's had a nice start to his career. But also just when you watch him take BP, the way his swing works through the zone and his balance. I mean, we're very proud of the bats we have right now. And we do have some pitching, too. I mean, we certainly have some young arms coming. We're very proud of what Eric Fetty did last year. I think he's going to take a big step forward again this year. And certainly have some younger pitchers as well that we're proud of, and Tyler Watson, and hoping to see Jesus Luzardo just get off the mound this year for the first time. And he's healthy and recovering very well. So, yeah, I would say I agree that really it's tools, athleticism, up the middle, diamond players. And then at shortstop, we have these very young crop of exciting young shortstops, and Carter Kieboom, who's having a great early camp, and then a young Luis Garcia, Yasiel Altuna, and Jose Sanchez coming out of the Dominican program with our scouts down there, and Johnny DePuglia signed those three shortstops last year. So, excited about the depth there.
All right, so a couple fun ones to wrap up, and you can't use any Nationals affiliates for these.
Okay.
Your favorite minor league park to visit, or that you have visited, and your favorite minor league nickname over the years?
I think, it's funny. I may go with one of our rival teams, because I was there last year, and I think I can just say with both. I think the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs might be one of my favorite nicknames, and I think the ballpark was pretty unique and neat to visit as well. So, I've been through a lot of minor league ballparks, and there's some great ones out there, and that was pretty neat experience. So I'll just say that.
Okay.
And simple, even though it's our rival.
And then other than I qualified it with no Nationals affiliate, so you're okay there. And then other than the Cowboy Monkey Rodeo in Potomac, do you have any favorite minor league promotions or giveaways?
There is a dog, and I can't remember who it was, but there's this dog that's like one of the best athletic dogs I've ever seen. And just like, he throws frisbees, and he might throw them like 200
yards. Frisbee dogs
are
amazing.
And he can just, the athleticism in that dog. I'm like, I wish I had one of those, and you can teach him. But those shepherds, I think, I don't know if it's Australian Shepherd or what it
right.
is, but they're amazing. And I'd say that's probably the most entertaining, because I'll actually sit there and bear down and watch. And I am scouting the dog, I guess. That's pretty fun.
He's a good up-the-middle player.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, like you said, you got a scrimmage this afternoon for the early camp, so we'll let you go. Thank you for your time, and I hope you enjoyed being the first ever podcast guest.
Thanks, Kyle. Appreciate it.
So thanks again to Mark for joining us and being so gracious with his time. This time of year, there's a lot going on the minor league side of the complex, so it's great that he's able to spend about 15 minutes with us talking about his career path and some of his philosophies and beliefs on player development, and giving us a little bit of a look into how the player development system works and how the player development staff goes about their business. So our next guest is Charlie Slows. Charlie is the original play-by-play voice of the Washington Nationals. He joined the club in 2005, and 2017 marks his 20th consecutive year calling Major League Baseball games, his 25th overall. So in our interview with Charlie, we talked about, you know, the new facility, his history with the club, his game preparation. And then we got into some of his thoughts on how spring training is going so far and some of the new players on the club that we've been able to look at for the first time. So here's our interview with Charlie Slows. So welcome back to the Curly W Live podcast. I'm very honored to be joined by Charlie Slows, the radio voice of the Washington Nationals. We are coming to you from the radio booth at the ballpark of the Palm Beaches, where this afternoon the Nationals won an exciting 5-4 game win, had an exciting 5-4 win over the neighboring Houston Astros, Andrew Stevenson, with a walk-off hit in the bottom of the ninth inning. So my first question for you, Charlie, is your walk-off call in midseason form? Or are you still in spring training form? Or where are you in your spring in your preparation?
Well, I'd probably say at this point we're close to being regular season ready. It really doesn't take Dave and I that long to get a rhythm. The hardest part of these spring training games at some point is remembering who's on the field at what position when you get late into the games and you've had multiple changes in positions. In particular, this game, we saw the Astros lose their DH by putting him into the field, John Singleton, to play first base in the bottom of the ninth inning. We don't know if there would have been an inning after that. Probably not.
Hope not.
They wouldn't have done it. But we'll see how that would have played out. But the Nationals ended up winning the game. And Stevenson's been a guy that Dusty Baker's been impressed with, speed. He puts the bat on the ball. You can't steal first with that speed.
Right.
So he put the bat on the ball to get on base. And he's been impressive both as an offensive player and looks pretty strong in the outfield.
I mentioned that to somebody today. It seems like he plays every spring training game, and every time he plays, he does something. He's really good at going back on the ball. I remember a game in Jupiter about a week ago. The wind was about 40 miles an hour in and swirling, and he had some balls go out to him in right field. He turned his head, sprinted, got to a spot, and was ready for it, and was pretty impressive. So we're here at the ballpark of the Palm Beaches. You've done a few games. You're here for some of the workouts. What are your overall impressions of our new facility, and what have you thought so far?
Well, I think it's tremendous, and they're going to be working on it probably until July, I'm told, finishing touches, and then figure out what things they want to add or redo for next year. But I think the facility's great. It's great for the fans more than anything. Tremendous facilities for the players. Upgrades from what they had in Vieira for a facility that was built originally for the Marlins in 1993. And, all the fields are just outside the clubhouse in the back. There's no long going down the road of the minor league complex. And, just tremendous weight room. They have the therapy pool, kitchen, dining area, everything they could need for amenities to do what they do. Proximity of all the fields, the fans being able to watch everything. And then, you've got a state-of-the-art ballpark, open concourse. So if you're going to go get something to eat, you don't miss the game. You can actually hear the game being broadcast around the park as well, which they couldn't do in Vieira. So, and you know what? I haven't heard many people talk about it because you start to just almost assume that it's going to be like this, but they were able to mirror the main Nats HD features on the scoreboard and video board here, which is state-of-the-art, and really, I haven't seen anything, maybe some of the newer parks in Arizona are like that. I haven't seen anything like that in spring training.
Yeah, and to go along with that, we noticed out on the practice fields, field one and field two are shaped like Nationals Park in terms of dimensions and the wall height and wall cutout, so it's helped the outfielders a lot this spring. A guy like Adam Eaton, who's never really played in Nationals Park, can go out there and, get balls off the wall, go back on balls, find out where all the nooks and crannies are in the outfield. So I believe when the Astros play, the scoreboard takes shape of their graphics,
right,
their arts too, which is really cool. So what we want to do in this podcast a little bit is when we meet with guests is talk a little bit about their career path and their preparation for games. So for you, you graduated from Fordham and from there went to KMOX in St. Louis and eventually worked your way up through various stops before becoming the voice of the Bullets, Washington Bullets in 86. Stayed there until 1988 when you become the radio voice of the Tampa Bay Rays. And then from there in 05, as we talked about in the intro a little bit, you joined the club in February of 2005. And I know I've talked about this with you a little bit off camera or off, off the record a bit maybe, but that spring in February 2005, when you became the voice of the Nationals, what was that transition like? Because everything was changing and it just seemed, I know you've told me before, but it's a pretty crazy story from what I remember.
Well, it was interesting because I kind of knew late in the 2004 season in Tampa Bay that the broadcast situation had a really good chance of changing because the radio company owned the rights was not going to renew, and the club was faced with either getting another rights fee from somebody else or taking it what they call in-house, buying the airtime and selling themselves. And what it turned out to be was they were going to buy the airtime and they weren't going to spend the money on radio broadcasters that the radio company was paying before. So it kind of went through all the way to February when I found out I wasn't going back to Tampa Bay. At the same time, I was talking to people who were going to run the Nationals, Tony Tavares and Kevin Ulick, for Major League Baseball, because the team was owned by Major League Baseball, or in essence the other 29 clubs owned the Montreal Expos as they were becoming the Washington Nationals. And it wasn't until February 24th that they called me and said they get a go-ahead from Major League Baseball. Once they had, were pretty sure they secured a stadium deal for the Nationals that would be Nationals Park in 2008, and they were going to play 3 years at RFK Stadium. At that point, that they said, okay, we can go ahead and hire radio broadcasters. And we were literally a week away from the first game. They said, are you available to do a game next Saturday? I said, I am. Can you guys get one on the air that quickly? And it was pretty much like that. Within a few days, I was driving to Vieira. The first game was against the Orioles in Fort Lauderdale. And there we went.
Did you, I mean, in terms of knowing the players and studying the roster, what was that like for you? Were you kind of looking at them from afar from the beginning, or, you know, was it kind of like a cram session that last week?
Kind of both. I mean, you know, I had a look on a chance that, you know, I knew I was in the running, whether it would come down to the end that I would be the guy. I had an idea of the roster and read up on the Expos a little bit, but then even more so, it's a crash course. But, you know, as soon as I was hired, like 2 days later, I was in Vieira and spent like, you know, 4 days of, you know, getting to know the team before I was going to broadcast the game. But still, it was interesting. It's, you know, and having been in the American League, seeing the Orioles, that was a team that I probably did more preparation
right
at that point on my own team, so to speak, than I would the other way around.
Right.
Whereas normally when you get into the season and you're facing another club, you know your team.
Right.
The preparation is mostly what you're going to talk about with the other team. Mm-hmm.
So that's a good transition. In terms of preparation, I'm always curious. You know, we play at 7 o'clock on, you know, in April. From the time kind of, I guess, you wake up in the morning, from there, what's your preparation like from there until first pitch, and then in game, what are you doing? What adjustments are you making? What are you trying to figure out in game?
Well, in this day and age, and it seems, as you know, for your job, preparation could be, if there was 24 hours in the day that you could stay awake, you would be continually preparing with the amount of information that's available now on the web and from Baseball Reference and from FanGraphs. It's just endless streams of information. But, you know, we try and combine not only numbers, but, you know, stories about the players, background. And so, you know, the first day of a series is the first time we play a team at the beginning of the year. And the first day of a series is the most preparation. Updating what I like to have in a notebook. Really, it's kind of something I started doing from the NBA. I don't have to do it. I could do a game without doing it, but it's a comfort level of what you have in front of you. And when I worked in the NBA doing the bullets, you only had so much space at press table when you were courtside that you couldn't just, well, I'm going to flip through media guy. I'm going to put this book out. So I would condense everything into like one page that included every player, which is a little different than the NBA because there was only 12 players on a roster back then. And so I kind of adapted that to the computer age of baseball where I build a file on each player and it'll have their run of statistics, other information that I want, basic bio kind of stuff, notes about transactions, injuries, basically taking information that's in all different places and kind of putting it in one spot. Cause
so you don't have to click over. And
it's like the speed of finding something. And then during the game, I'll use the computer mostly for updates of out-of-town scores, or if we have to look up something about a player that maybe we didn't know. But, you know, there's so many places to find things. Dave and I still are kind of – I've seen some people at high school games now. They have a program on a tablet that you can score a game on. And it'll create a box score and everything. But we're still the old-fashioned scorebook. They like to put in the stats that the player has to that point of the year, team stats, standing. So you can look back at any point in the year – and not only you'll know what the guy was hitting going into that game, and then we also keep a day-by-day handwritten of every player.
Wow.
so we can go back and look in streaks, even though you could go to Baseball Reference and find a streak. Sometimes having it by hand is the quickest way to find something.
I always think that you guys need things a lot faster than, say, a writer or a reporter that can think about something, take a few minutes to look it up, find it, add it to the article. You guys need to pretty much be ready on the fly with everything.
Yeah, and we kid on the air while the interns are at work looking up something, but that's usually whichever one of us isn't doing play-by-play. And sometimes listeners will send us stuff. They'll look it up.
Hey, when I hear the word intern, I look – if I'm listening to you, often when we're on the road and I'm on the trip, I listen to you guys. And when I hear the word intern, I open Baseball Reference or Stats Pass and try to help you out as fast as possible too.
That's the whole thing. You're trying to get to something if you can before the next pitch is delivered, you know, that kind of thing. So we try and stay up on everything as much as possible. We try and, you know, intersperse the scores of other games. Right. We have sponsored segment for it in the fifth inning. But, you know, as you get later in the year and games matter more in the standings, we try and stay on top of it. If someone's throwing a no-hitter, we'll pull that game up and one of us will monitor that game. And, you know, sometimes we have control of the
pennant monitor race or something like that. Yeah.
You know, that's when it really gets fun, when all that kind of stuff is going on. But we're really just a big series of multitasks going on at once. And that's what, when you reach the end of the night and you have that adrenaline rush, the game's over and the team's won. And then you have that that all of a sudden.
Right. You got to come down from it a little bit.
Yeah. And that's when you're like, well, you're sitting most of the time. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem that physical, but your brain's going 12 different directions.
So this year, the Nationals, or this offseason, I should say, they added a couple new guys to the 40-man roster, so I thought it'd be good to kind of run through those guys for the fans. They haven't gotten many looks at them so far, but, you know, kind of what have you seen from them so far? What have you thought? We'll start with, go by position by position, Austin Adams. Nationals acquired him from the Angels with Kyle MacGowan in exchange for Danny Espinosa. Actually, the second year in a row that the Nationals made a trade with the Angels, sent them an infielder, and received two pitchers. Almost to the day
that they did
the UNL Escobar trade. So he went 0-1 with a 3.05 ERA in 32 games for Double A Arkansas last year. And what I noticed about him was his high strikeout numbers.
Right.
60 in 41 innings.
We really haven't seen much of him, but one appearance so far in the spring. So in another game that I was at that we weren't broadcasting, he got hit around a little bit in that one. So he was a little bit wild. So, you know, we haven't seen enough of him to really form an opinion of him at this point. We've seen Jimmy Cordero and the big fastball. Right. But again, what we heard about him from the Phillies people is, you know, command is a big issue with him. Kind of reminds you of Henry Rodriguez going back a few years. Hopefully he could harness it with that big fastball.
Right. Another guy, Eni Romero, who actually, as we look up on TV, last I looked, Dominican Republic just took the 5-3 lead. He was pitching for the Dominican, so it looks like he's in line for this win if they can finish it off. He was acquired from Tampa this offseason. Hard-throwing left-handed pitcher. He's appeared in 76 games across three major league seasons with the Rays. Good strikeout numbers. Again, 50 strikeouts and 45 and two-thirds innings pitched. I've seen him, the stadium gun readings up to 97, 98 miles an hour.
Yeah, that's big-time stuff. I think, you know, a lot will depend how the Nationals make up their bullpen, whether they're going to, you know, three lefties. Well, that's a luxury for a manager. You have Ali Perez on a guaranteed deal, also pitching the World Baseball Classic for Mexico. And you have Sammy Solis, who was a big-time step up last year, really progressing as a reliever.
Right.
Sammy's had, you know, a couple – you know, when he pitches a lot, you worry about his ability, you know, abilities to stay healthy. Mm-hmm. He was on the DL a couple of times last year. And so the Nationals have some choices there. And see if they can keep all three. It just depends on how they make up the right side of the bullpen.
Right. Next up, moving to position players a bit, Adam Lind. He strengthens Nationals' already strong bench. He's been really good against righties in his career. He's in the top 10 in home runs on Toronto's all-time home run list. So I think he strengthens. The Nationals have had a pretty strong bench the last year, brought a lot of those same guys back, and I think he only makes the bench a little bit better.
Yeah, it's interesting because the Nationals have become more of a left-hand hitting team than right-handed.
Right.
And he and Clint Robinson are similar in what they do. Power bat from the left side, mainly first baseman who can play a little bit outfield. So it remains to be seen whether they can, like the bullpen on the left side, can they keep both of them? Because Stephen Drews, your backup infielder, is also left-handed. Chris Heisey's back from the right side on the bench. So that would be four players right there. If they all made it, then your only other
is if, the catcher.
Is the backup catcher, assuming you have seven relievers and five starters.
The next, Adam Eaton, he's arguably the key acquisition of the offseason. A lot of stuff was written about, you know, when the Nationals acquired him, they acquired him in exchange for Giolito and Ronaldo Lopez. And, you know, we've seen him work out in the outfield. He, you know, he brings a lot of talent to the outfield. You know, he covers a lot of ground in both directions. So a lot of talk this spring has been, you know, where is he going to hit? Where is he going to hit? He's hitting Dusty's lineup in spring training, I believe, first, second, fifth, sixth, seventh. So I think it gives Dusty a lot of options because he has that type of approach that kind of translates to a lot of different spots.
I think, you know, Dusty's pretty much settled on Turner being the leadoff batter, it looks like. Because almost every time I've seen Turner play, he's batted first in the order.
Right.
While he's moved Eaton around at the different spots in the order. And because of, you have potentially Murphy and Harper who batted one in front of the other. If you had Eaton second, you had the potential for three left-hand hitters in a row at the top of the order, which is why I think he would look to move Eaton down. You're susceptible to teams with good left-handed relievers. You have three in a row like that. So I think he'd like to bat Eaton second, but then how do you break up Harper and Murphy?
The lefties, yep.
You know, if you get a lot of offense from, say, Jason or Ryan Zimmerman, then maybe you pop them in the middle of Murphy and Harper.
Let them bat three,
how they started last year. Right. But when Zim didn't hit, that changed everything.
Next up, he actually made his Nationals spring debut this afternoon, was Matt Wieters. Late addition to the club, acquired February 24th. Four-time All-Star, Gold Glove winner, hit 17 home runs and 66 RBIs in 124 games for Baltimore last year. Switching in catcher, like I said, today was his first action. I think he only played three innings. But like I said, big addition late in the spring that only lengthens the Nationals lineup.
Yeah, veteran catcher. Switch hitter with power, another year removed from that Tommy John surgery, so defensively throwing the ball better, and seemingly nothing gets by him. You don't see him ever have a lot of pass balls.
One last year or nothing, maybe?
And you're going to help pitchers not record wild pitches. He keeps balls in front of him and they don't move up. You know, that was a difficult situation for the Nationals in that Wilson Ramos had his career year, his best year, and the unfortunate injury with a week to go in the season blows out his knee. Or what, Matt Wieters is probably not here. Ramos a free agent, but if he's healthy, pretty good chance the Nationals would have been interested in re-signing and Ramos would have wanted to stay. So that changed a lot in the offseason, first with trading for Derek Norris and then now signing Wieters. So the Nationals have depth at catching. A veteran who's good at handling the pitchers. I'm really looking forward to seeing him on an everyday basis because I'm glad he's not hitting against us. Because over the years, he killed the Nats in those series with the Orioles.
Yeah, it makes the lineup pretty strong 1-8 with him, you know, wherever Dusty decides to settle on him. And the latest addition was Joe Blanton. Nationals saw him in the postseason last year. He had a strong 2016 campaign, went 7-2 with a 2.48 ERA. Career high 75 appearances for the Dodgers, and we've all known Joe Blanton as baseball fans for a long time as a starter with Oakland and Philadelphia. Won a World Series with Phillies as a teammate, Jason Wirth. And you know, since he converted to the relief role in 2015, he's posted a 2.2 ERA, 28 holds, has struck out more than a batter per inning. So he's a guy who's late in his career has made quite the transition, and it's pretty amazing that he was, you know, unsigned up until I believe March 2nd when the Nationals swooped in and brought him on board.
Yeah, you go back a couple of years, he didn't pitch in the big leagues. Right. He missed an entire year at that point in his career. You talk about when he was a starter, whenever he seemed to do well, he would get hurt. He just couldn't seem to stay healthy. And again, like Wieters, the Nationals could not touch him. They could not hit him last year with the Dodgers, so I'd rather if you can't,
on our side.
Yeah. You can't beat him, join him, so to speak. And he said when I talked to him in the clubhouse last weekend, he said, hey, you know, I'm whenever they want to put me in a game, he goes, it's not because I wasn't here that I'm not ready.
Right.
I'm ready. Right. I just wasn't here. And then I saw him pitch here on Friday.
Yeah.
He was lights out in that
strong
one.
Strong seventh inning,
Lights out on like six pitches.
Yeah. It's like he didn't it's like he was ready to go. Like you said, he hit the ground running when he got here. He worked out, I believe, with the junior college back home through to those kids.
He looks like he's in, to me, the best physical shape that he's ever been in. He looks like he's dropped some weight, and he looks really good. I think that gives them depth in the bullpen where they figure out who's going to be the closer out of the gate, whether it's Sean Kelly, who certainly has the stuff, the strikeout. You want it to be a strikeout pitcher to be the closer. Swing and miss stuff. There's all questions last year. Would they pitch him 3 days in a row? They didn't want to do that. Closer, you might have to pitch four times in 6 days or five and seven if your team's hot and those opportunities come up. Will they do that with him? Because Dusty said he does not want to go with multiple closers.
Right.
And so, again, now that you have Blanton here, it just lengthens what you might do. Blake Treinen has closer-type stuff as well with that heavy sinker, the slider, and last year really stepped up as far as being able to get left-handed hitters out, which 2 years ago was a struggle for him. And so that when he had a high average against him with left-hand hitters, it made him more of a right-handed specialist. So there's definitely options. And then there's Cota Glover, who's looked tremendous this spring, but very little experience at the big league level. He's been a closer all throughout his minor league career. Maybe he's the guy best suited to do it, but is he the guy right out of the gate at the start of the season?
Dusty's been asked a lot about this since the start of spring training, and so have Blake Treinen and Sean Kelly, and a lot of their answers, it's been very positive. And, you know, I think Sean Kelly was one who said we don't have no closers in here. We have a lot of closers in here. And Dusty's made mention a couple of times. There was one time, you know, where Mariano Rivera didn't have any saves. And look, you know.
He was a setup guy.
Exactly. So I think Dusty, like you said, he has options. There's three really strong candidates, and it's better than having zero options. I think that's kind of what he's gotten at.
They all have the stuff, and, you know, it's only in recent years that guys would come to the big leagues as closers from the minor leagues. It used to be they were all starting pitchers. Mm-hmm. Everyone was a starting pitcher.
Everyone's a starter,
until, you know, there weren't enough roles for them. It's, okay, we're going to put you in the bullpen, and then you'd go in the bullpen and you weren't a starter. And it was just an evolution that eventually you had success as a reliever. You had the stuff. Somebody else faltered. They tried somebody else. You become the guy.
Right. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. It's March 12th right now. So the Nationals will enjoy their second and final off day of the season, of the spring season, on Tuesday.
Which is odd to have the last off day that early.
Right. And then their next off day will be the Sunday before opening day. You're back on the air tomorrow, right?
Yep, we have tomorrow, and then we have two games next weekend, and then Friday, Saturday, the following weekend.
Okay.
And then we have the two games, one in Washington and the one at the Naval Academy, before we get this going, 3 weeks from tomorrow.
Absolutely. All right, Charlie, well, thank you for spending your time with us this afternoon, and look forward to listening to you on 106.7, 1580, and 1500 the rest of the spring, and thanks again.
You got it, Kyle.
Thanks again to Mark and Charlie for joining us on the first ever Curly W Live podcast. So looking ahead at the schedule, the Nationals will enjoy their second and final off day of spring training on Tuesday, March 14th. From there, Washington will play every day until April 2nd, their final off day prior to opening day at home against the Miami Marlins. So be sure to check out nationals.com for broadcast schedules and information so you don't miss a minute of the action. So we want your feedback on the podcast, so feel free to tweet at me, at Kyle Brostowitz, or at Nationals with your thoughts, and you know, feel free to leave comments on Curly W Live as well. And just a reminder, you can always find the podcast on Curly W Live, nationals.com, and more locations as we move forward. So until next time, Nationals fans, thanks for tuning in, and tell your friends.